I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, unemployment is up, the GDP is down, but economists are still kind of happy. Well, as happy as economists get. NPR's Marilyn Geewax is going to interpret all that for us in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to a debate that our national leaders are finally taking up again over how to fix an immigration system that just about everybody agrees is broken. Earlier this week, both President Obama and a bipartisan group of senators presented ideas for doing that. But we were thinking that this would be a good time to check in with two leaders who are close to the issue because they lead cities that are close to the southern border. Scott Smith is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. He's a Republican. Welcome back, Mayor Smith. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
And David Koss is the mayor of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's a Democrat. Mayor Koss, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
So, Mayor Smith, I'm going to go to you first. We spoke with you last during the Republican National Convention back in August, and we talked a little bit about immigration ideas back then. At the time, you said that the DREAM Act, the president's deferred action plans, that would, you know, offer a path to citizenship for people, young people who were brought here, you know, by their parents as minors and so forth. But anyway, you all said that those were band-aids, that they were counterproductive. So talk about the latest ideas coming out of Washington. Do you think that they do a better job of actually addressing the issue?
Well, I think they do a better job. And there's no doubt that the election in November changed that discussion from when we were talking in Tampa in August. It gave a certain sense of urgency. And it also made Republicans realize this was an issue they could no longer ignore. If they did so, they did so at their own peril. I was very, very encouraged by both the president and the senators coming out and actually putting something on the table that I think begins a serious discussion with hopes for some serious action.
So what's the most important thing going forward that you would like the federal leaders to keep in mind from your perspective as a local leader who's probably sort of seeing this every day?
Well, you know, the problem with our immigration debate is we seem to talk about the wrong things, or if we talk about the things, we don't recognize how important this is to us. There's a couple of things we deal with here in Arizona, and that is in local cities, we bear the brunt of immigration that is not fixed. We bear the brunt of in Arizona, because we are a corridor for organized crime, human smuggling, drugs, all those things that now have seemed to come together. Our local police, our local citizens, we see this every day. And yet sometimes we feel like we get no real support because it gets lost in the rhetoric. But on the other hand, immigration is at the foremost an economic issue. And whether we're talking about unskilled labor, whether we're talking about being able to meet the needs of a world economy in the 21st century with highly skilled labor, we seem to not really hit the whole thing during the debate.
Okay. Mayor Koss, what about you? What's the most important thing you want national leaders to keep in mind from your perspective as a person who's seeing this every day?
Well, you know, I think first I agree with a lot of what Mayor Smith was saying, but I want them to hurry. You know, this has been an issue in our communities for decades now that costs us as community every day. I think the most important thing is to bring our community members that are without documentation right now, give them some legal status, bring them out of the shadows, and let them participate in our communities.
You know, you actually talked about this. You talked about the immigration issue during your State of the City speech last October. One of the things
right.
that you said is that one of the reasons that New Mexico allows young people, regardless of immigration status, to attend college if they graduated from a New Mexico high school, and that with proper identification, you issue driver's licenses so that people can work and attend to the daily business of life. Talk a little bit more about that. And is that something that you want national leaders to pursue as a model as they go forward?
Well, I absolutely do want national leaders to pursue that, and I'm really pleased that the state of Illinois recently signed legislation allowing driver's licenses. But I think one of the most important stories in Santa Fe, in my community, are the Dreamers, are the young people that are here that may have come when they were 2 or 3 or 5 or 6 years old that are now they're now in college. They're some of the energy and the vitality in the Santa Fe community and in the New Mexico community. So we thought as a state it just made sense to support their educations and to support their ability to get an education and to get a job with the driver's license program. So, you know, I'm very proud of what my state has done and what my city has done in terms of dealing with immigration. But we really do need the federal government. I'm so encouraged by the president and Congress right now to act quickly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about some of the immigration reform ideas, but we're checking with two local leaders who are both leading cities in border states. Mayor Scott Smith from Mesa, Arizona, Mayor David Koss from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Mayor Smith, one of the things we were noticing is, you know, Arizona has been very much in the news because of a very tough stance, what is described as a very sort of tough enforcement-driven stance on immigration. New Mexico's taking a different road, even though, you know, they both have Republican governors. They're both led by women, interestingly enough. But they seem to have a very different philosophy around these issues. And I was just wondering if you agree with my assessment, Mayor Smith, and why do you think that is?
Well, they do have different philosophies because they're even though we're neighbors, our histories are intertwined. The immigration issue and experience in New Mexico is very different than the issue in Arizona. Arizona is now the funnel. Arizona is where well over half the traffic of human smuggling passes through. Illegal drugs, a vast majority of illegal drugs now pass through Arizona. And that's due to geography. That's due to where our highways and cities are located. We have become the superhighway. So we have a very different experience with the bad side, the downside, the organized crime side. And it's very different than Texas, New Mexico, or California. Everything seems to have funneled through Arizona. And I think that's built up a very much a frustration here that that stems from a lack of trust that the federal government truly understands our issues. A lot of the things that have done in Arizona are really acts of desperation in many ways and screams of frustration, help, deal with us. And that's very different than what I found in the other border states. The attitudes are very different here.
Can I ask Mayor Koss about that? What do you think about that, Mayor Koss?
Well, you know, New Mexico used to be part of Mexico, so we do have a very different attitude and experience. I think the issues that Scott's mentioning of human trafficking, drug trafficking, organized crime, we do experience those in New Mexico. We're having gang-related shootings and murders right in my city and my region, which is almost 300 miles north of the border. And, you know, I share Mayor Smith's frustration at the lack of inaction from the federal government. But it's not just in enforcement, though. We always need that help. It's in recognizing how many families live and work in our communities that need to come out of this legal limbo that they've been in for sometimes now decades. And that's holding back our town.
Mayor Smith, can I run something by you? A number of people, including the so-called Gang of Eight senators, suggest that the border needs to be secured before undocumented immigrants can seek citizenship. President Obama, in his remarks, suggested on Tuesday that the border is already secure. I just want to play a short clip from his remarks.
We put more boots on the ground on the southern border than at any time in our history. And today, illegal crossings are down nearly 80% from their peak in 2000.
So, Mayor Smith, do you think that that's true? Do you think that the border is already secure and that now it's time to turn to other matters?
I think that's the problem, is that nobody knows how to truly define what secure is. And I know that in Arizona, that's a big deal. And I think what we'll have to do to get some sort of agreement is come to some level of trust. There's no way that I think you can define some objective standard that it's going to make everybody happy. But what you can do, and what I think that would go a long way, is there becomes some sort of mechanism, some sort of plan that states that the federal government truly is putting forth an effort. And I think that means the administration needs to move a little bit and recognize that there's a lack of trust. On the other side, those who are clamoring for security needs to understand that having a zero tolerance border is not achievable, but there are things that can be done to make people have trust that the effort is there. Whether it be internal enforcement, whether it be new boots on the ground, I don't know what the answer is, but that's certainly going to be a major issue between bringing the two sides together, is that there be some sort of plan, some level of trust that's an important issue and it's being dealt with in a level that makes people feel comfortable. Right now they don't in Arizona. I think that that the federal government certainly has stepped up their efforts. You know, I don't know how you make everybody happy on that. We're going to have to find common ground.
Mayor Koss, I'm going to give you the last word. Do you feel trust or confidence, perhaps we could put it that way, that or even perhaps vindication that the issue that so consumes so much of your time and energy is finally getting the attention that it deserves? Or, and do you feel that there will be some kind of plan put in place at least, I think, in the near future?
I think the time has come. I think my community, all of us U.S. citizens and immigrant community, feel very hopeful right now to see the president and Congress taking this issue on. I don't think enforcement is our first priority. I think the Obama administration has done more enforcement and more work than anybody else ever has. But we in Santa Fe and New Mexico don't really want to see a militarized border. I think, again, the most important thing are the families and the workers that are with us right now in New Mexico, and giving them a status where they can be part of our communities, full members of our community, getting educations, getting jobs, starting businesses, raising families. That's just critical right now.
David Koss is the mayor of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's a Democrat. He joined us from there. Scott Smith is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. He's a Republican. He spoke with us from NPR member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Thank you both so much for joining us, mayors both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good job, Scott.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, Back Talk. That's where we hear what some of you have to say about some of the stories we've covered recently. That's ahead. First, though, there's news about jobs. The Labor Department released its report for January today. Employers added 157,000 new jobs last month. Still, the unemployment rate inched up to 7.9%. Many economists, though, think spring could bring good news. They're hopeful that the housing market could be on its way back, and that could bring with it jobs in other areas. Here to tell us more about this is NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. She joins us regularly. Marilyn, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
So let's start with the new jobs report. Unemployment ticked up slightly, so give us a read on this.
It was a medium-ish report. It wasn't great. It wasn't bad. Yes, the unemployment rate ticked up to 7.9%, but, you know, it's been bumping around in a very narrow range. For about the last 6 months, basically, we're running at a little bit less than 8% unemployment, and job growth is steady, though uninspiring. We had about 157,000 new jobs. Wish it was twice that, but, you know, it continues moving upward.
But what about this other number that came out this week? That was the number for gross domestic product. That measures the total value of goods and services that we produce in the U.S. That number dropped. And that's the first time that that number has dropped since 2009. How should we read that?
The headline on that looks pretty ugly. But let's stop and think about what really happened there. To understand the gross domestic product, think about it this way. It's a giant shopping cart, and in that cart, you throw in everything that we make domestically. That is, all the goods, all the services, and then every 3 months, the government rolls that big shopping cart up to a cash register, and we get a read on how much is in there. Well, when they added it all up this time, they found that it shrunk a little bit. Somebody took something out of our basket. Now, why did that happen? Might have just been a bad cashier. Maybe we just got a bad reading, and probably it was a little bit better than what we thought. But there's no question that the economy did slow down in October, November, December. Those 3 months weren't great. And the reasons for that? A lot of them, but mostly it was Congress. This idea that we were facing this big fiscal cliff, as we called it, there was a lot of uncertainty. The defense industry pulled back dramatically. They didn't know what was going to happen with their budgets. We also had weird things that happened, Hurricane Sandy and various disruptions. So the economy seems to have slowed a great deal towards the end of the year. But there's a lot in there that actually, if you root around in that shopping cart and you look at what all have we got in there, there are reasons why you should be optimistic probably for spring.
Okay, well, let's hear about that.
Okay. Well, why am I happy about my shopping cart? Because a lot of what we're buying in there are things like lots to build houses on. People are getting ready for what looks like it may be a very good spring for housing starts. Now, we've had a terrible housing market for, years, since 2006, really, it started turning down, and it's been horrible. But we've seen a real turnaround, and evidence of that showed up even in this latest jobs report. We see that construction companies added about 28,000 jobs. Now, we're still far below where we were a few years ago in construction, but it's coming back. There's been a lot of jobs added, almost 300,000 jobs in the past year or two, and we're getting back to where you feel like there's momentum there, and that will pick up through the spring.
Well, you can see where there's probably pent-up demand in the housing area, just because we've been hearing about people consolidating their households, for example, because
right.
of job loss. We've heard about young people, instead of going out, you know, after college and moving into their own place, moving back in with parents in order to save resources and things of that sort. So you can understand why there's kind of pent-up demand. But we
exactly.
also keep hearing that there's a lot of housing inventory out there that hasn't moved because of the recession. So what's the source of the optimism?
Well, here's the crazy thing about time marches on. As time passed, a lot of those people who were a few years ago, they were 24-year-olds sleeping in mom's basement. Now they're 30. They want to get married. They want to have kids. They're moving on. One way or the other, they've saved enough money by living at home. There really were a lot of families that doubled up. That really did happen. It was statistically significant. So you've had a lot of people who saved money by doubling up, and now they have enough money for a down payment, and they want to start to move on. There are also people who have aged out of the house that they lived in, baby boomers who want to move to a condo. So there's all of a sudden a lot of people who, just because time has passed, are ready to move in one way or the other. And we're seeing a lot of evidence that that's really happening because prices are rising. There's just no question. You know, usually economists are sort of argue with each other, and there's the one hand and there's the other hand. Right now, there's a consensus among economists. Everyone agrees that the housing market is strengthening, prices are rising, there are more homes being built. And on this question of inventory, this comes back again to the idea of time marches on. Houses that were vacant because of foreclosures 3 and 4 and 5 years ago, frankly, they're ruined. There's sort of a lot of teardowns out there where inventory is sort of going away because the houses just aren't suitable anymore. So people are coming into neighborhoods, scraping down those old vacant houses and building new ones. So we're starting to see much more demand for new homes, and new homes spin off lots and lots of jobs. You have landscapers and roofers and electricians and all sorts of people get involved when new homes are being built. So there's a lot of reason to believe that in coming months, that economic driver of new homes is going to start to perk up.
Well, that is a hopeful note on which to conclude today. That was NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax, who joins us often to talk about matters of the economy. And she joined us once again from our studios in Washington, D.C. Marilyn, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we speak about matters of faith and spirituality. And today we are going to check back in with a faith leader who made a big impression on us, among other people, at the height of the recovery efforts after Sandy. That's the storm that tore through the Northeast about 3 months ago. Congress just passed an emergency aid package for victims after an appeal from area lawmakers who stressed that many people are still struggling. Now, back in November, you might remember that we spoke with Monsignor John Brown of St. Francis de Sales. That's in Rockaway, Queens. It was one of the hardest hit areas. The church and the school were serving as kind of a center for storm relief. Let's listen.
At the present time, we're serving between 4 and 10,000 people a day.
What? Four and 10,000 people, like food and clothes, everything?
Yeah, that's food, that's clothing, that's toiletries, that's cleaning stuff. Everything somebody would need to try to survive day by day. We've served over 50,000.
Now, we told Monsignor Brown that we were going to check back in with him to find out how things are going. So we have now done so, and he is with us now. Monsignor, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for calling back.
Well,
you kept your word.
Yes, we sure did. Well, how are you?
I'm doing okay. The neighborhood's coming together little by little. It's much quieter now. The disaster relief center is closed. All our tents are closed. Right now we're in the process of trying to fix our church buildings that serve the community so well during the storm and the recovery. Now it's our turn to try to put everything back together.
Well, that was one of the things that we talked about, is that space in the church is taken up with distributing things and just dealing with people's immediate needs. You're still trying to figure out how to do the church's, you know, actual mission. Are you now able to hold services in church? Are you able to do all the kinds of things that you were doing before, the kinds of meetings that people often have in church?
Some of it, not all of it. We tried to keep mass going throughout the storm recovery. We had one mass a day. We still do. and on weekends we have three masses. The church, we have our lights, we have our heat back. It's not perfect, but it's coming along. We were very lucky because what happened was our infrastructure was totally destroyed, but we were able to work on it while we had the disaster relief center. So we just reopened our school, and I just moved back into my rectory. It's coming together slowly but surely.
And what's it like being back in your own
It's very
bed.
Nice to be back and sleep in your own bed. It's been, I was staying at a friend's house for the last 3 months or so, and another rectory, and it was a little rough. You know, it's never your own home, and it's never your own bed, but this is nice just to be back.
We've been talking a lot about the church and the school itself, but what about the neighborhood?
The neighborhood is coming back slowly. Most people are beginning to come back now. I would say about probably around 80% of the people are back, but not everybody is living here full-time because some of the people still have problems with electricity and heating and et cetera, so it's not all that comfortable for everybody yet, so there's still people living outside the Rockaways. But, you know, little by little and slowly but surely, people are kind of making their way back. You can see more life in the neighborhood.
When we talked the last time, I mean, there are two things. I mean, first, there are the physical needs that people have, but then there are the spiritual, emotional, and psychological needs that you
right.
that you take care of, you know, all the time anyway. And when we
right.
last talked, a lot of the people you were telling us were in shock. You know, how are people doing?
Yeah, I still think there's a matter of shock that people are trying to recover, realizing, as I always say now, it's a new normal. It's never going to be what it was. A lot of our memories are gone, but they're memories, and now we have to create a new normal. So it's going to be some difficult times. It's not certainly not over. It's not just a matter of, you know, fixing a basement and you're done. It's going to take time to get everybody back together.
What is it that you think most people need at this point?
I think for most people, they need a little rest. They need a little time away from the whole difficulty of dealing with the storm and dealing with what's facing them. People need a break, basically.
Forgive me for asking, but I find myself wondering, has this been a faith testing experience?
I think for many people it probably has. I think it opened up many people's eyes to the reality of life and not being in total control of everything every day. You know, there's always a feeling that they were in control of their destiny and they had things in the right place, and now all of a sudden their foundations have been shaken. What I'm very proud of with the parish is that on Sundays the Mass is becoming more and more crowded. As they come back to church. They never let go of their relationship with Christ and their church.
How do you minister to them at a time like this? I mean, what do you say?
Yeah, I think what you do is just make it as positive as possible. I would say my big theme is nothing is impossible with God. You point out the growth experiences, like having the children back, having houses repaired, more people moving back, trying to just remind each other, stay calm, help each other through the worst moments, and God will be here with us always. And it will continue because God is with us.
And, you know, I've got to ask, even though you may think this is a completely ridiculous question, what's keeping you going?
Yeah, hope in the future really keeps me moving. And my relationship with Christ just keeps me alive and thinking to myself, you know, reminding myself everything is possible with God.
Nice bottle of wine wouldn't hurt either, would it?
And a bottle of wine and a vacation.
To where? Someplace with no water?
I am leaving for the Caribbean tomorrow, and I'm going to stay on top of the water.
Okay. All right. Well, that's
going,
a good
I'm going
thing.
Away for a few days with some friends of mine just to kind of reamp my own batteries.
Well, you know what? They say you cannot pour from an empty vessel.
You got it.
So congratulations on that. Thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you for having us. And thank you for keeping up with us. I really appreciate it.
Monsignor John Brown is the senior pastor at St. Francis de Sales. That's in Rockaway, Queens. And he joined us from St. Francis by phone before he gets on a plane and goes someplace with more water. Go figure.
Amen.
And now it's time for Back Talk. That's where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere. Editor Ahmad Omar is with us. What's going on today, Ahmad?
Hey, Michelle. We've talked a lot in the past few weeks about gun violence on this program, and we've looked at the issue of mental health and the role that plays in gun violence as well. Well, we got a letter from Henry Chapman of Harleysville, Pennsylvania, and he's got a personal stake in this story. Here he is.
I am the guardian for a mentally ill parent who has suffered from psychosis and chronic paranoid schizophrenia for more than 47 years. addressing the issue of mental health care in the context of tragic consequences only exacerbates the stigma that already exists around mental illness.
And Henry wants more attention and support for caregivers of mentally ill people.
Well, thank you for that, Henry. And Henry, we're going to keep a good thought for you. Thank you for what you're doing. Ahmad, what else do you have?
All right, we've got some music, Michelle. If you tuned into this program a couple of weeks ago, you might have heard this. And let's see if you can name that tune, because Terry LaPenta Duffick heard it and she wanted to know what it was. Because when you give it up, when no matter what you do,
Terry, we do know that song. And yes, it is hot. It's My Kind of Love by rising star Emily Sandé. She was on the program and she sang some great songs for us. We'll certainly be hearing more from her.
Yeah, that's right. She's a British singer and she was the best-selling artist in the UK last year. Now she told you that she's trying to make her mark in the United States. We let Terry know that and she wrote back to us telling us that she went out and bought the album after we let her know who it was. And Terry's not alone. Emily's album, Our Version of Events, got back in the charts last week. It's in the Billboard Top 200 at number 199. That's one spot behind Eminem's Recovery.
All right. Thank you, Ahmad.
Thank you, Michelle.
So let's hear a little bit more of Emily Sandé. You know, our hearts beat only for you two. All right.
Of course.
Of course. So remember, at Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. We're on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for a weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel. He's with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar. Joining us from Boston, former doctor, now healthcare consultant, and a contributor to National Review magazine, Neil Minkoff. And in New York City, Pablo Torre. He is a senior writer with ESPN.com. Come. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey.
What's going on?
We do good.
All right. Well, it's Super Bowl shop this week.
What?
Yeah. Go Ravens. No. Go Ravens. You know I'm from Cleveland, right? So I got to represent. I can't cheer for the Browns, but there's always next year, right? But some fans are thinking twice about rooting for the San Francisco 49ers after cornerback Chris Culliver got caught up in a controversy. Michelle, oh, man, we got a sports star caught up in a controversy. Clutch
right?
the pearls.
I know. Clutch the pearls. How can we possibly imagine?
We got some tape, though, right?
You know, we do. Culliver, just to sort of give you the backstory, he was approached by radio personality Artie Lang. He's known as a regular guest for Howard Stern, commonly called Shock Jock, although they hate that term. They prefer talk show personality or
Heck.
Something like that. So then, anyway, Artie Lang asked Culliver about whether there were any gay players on the team, and this is what he said.
They don't got no gay people on the team. You know, they got to get up out of here if they do. Can't be with that sweet stuff. Nah.
Really? Is that true?
Yeah, it's true.
But they might be able to play well. I mean.
Nah.
No?
Nah. Can't be in the locker room. Nah.
Oh, okay. So they'd have to stay, keep it a secret.
Yeah, you got to come out 10 years later after that.
So Colliver later apologized for those comments, and he said he was through a spokesman. I'll just say that. And he said he was thrown off by being asked, quote, real disrespectful, unquote, questions. For example, previously Lang had asked him whether he would be hooking up with women or men before the game. So anyway, that's his story.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. It's a bug out to me that I really feel like he was led into this line of questioning that was designed to make him look kind of silly. That's number one. And number two, I'm not sure if we should persecute him because he's ignorant. You know, let his opinion evolve, like our president's opinion had to evolve at some point. You know, it bothers me that we bully people for their opinions not being PC enough in any given moment. And it always seems, especially with matters that involve homosexuality, that black men are always bullied for not evolving fast enough. And their opinion, and that's just my opinion. It took me some time for my opinion to evolve. I worked in a gay bar. I was a DJ. I worked in a gay bar for 4 years, and my opinion had to evolve. You know, everybody gets that right to be dumb, you know, at some point, to be ignorant at some point, and then have their opinion evolve. He doesn't need to be, okay, crucified for this. Pablo, you've reported on this. What do you think?
Okay, can I just clarify one thing, Pablo, that he also went on mic to apologize, too. I just thought I'd clarify.
Did.
Let me
read
that. Okay. Yeah.
Right. First off, Jimmy, I would have loved to have gone to that bar. That sounds like
it was the bomb. It was the bomb. The best music in the city.
I'm not even kidding. That sounds like it would be amazing.
It was.
So I guess where I differ with you on this is that, you know, well, I guess what was problematic for me and disappointing for me as somebody who sees anybody with that sort of opinion as being on the wrong side of history, the reason why I'm troubled by this is because he's from the San Francisco 49ers.
Right,
he plays in the Bay Area. And the first time I heard this, I was just like, you got to be kidding me.
So he should pander, right?
No, it's not he should pander. It's the matter of being not quite so insensitive. I mean, it's not like he was having again, it's Artie Lang. It's not sitting across the table from Charlie Rose. But it's not like this was a very tough IQ test either. I mean, what I grant is that the guy doesn't get interviewed very much. He's a low-level backup. It's fine. But what I'm troubled by is this is the exact type of language which is really troublesome in the NFL and in sports in particular. It's oftentimes not the guys who are beating their Bibles and going fire and brimstone on everybody. It's the guys who are joking about this very casually as if there's nothing wrong with it and as if you can be a normal person and really be that insensitive. And you know, maybe we have different barriers, different thresholds for PC-ness, but for me, it's that type of talk which is always, you know, that's how a stigma sort of festers. It's because it's very casual and it's off the cuff and it doesn't seem like it's a big deal until it is. And that's why we don't have these players coming out while they're active.
Hey, Trey.
So can I jump in here for a second?
Arslan wants to jump in here, and I'm going to hear from you too, Neil.
I'm going to co-sign my man Pablo here. You know, I think that there are a couple things to keep in mind. First of all, you know, this is not somebody having a political opinion, you know, opposing gay marriage, which, again, every you know, American has a right to believe. This is a person saying that a certain group of people would not be welcome in his locker room. So it's sort of a fill-in-the-blank thing. So instead of gay people, let's say Latinos are not welcome in our locker room, or Jewish or Muslim people are not welcome in our locker room. I think, you know, the uproar would be pretty unanimous there. And so, you know, for many people in the LGBT community, you know, this is part of their civil rights movement in America today. This is not, you know, evolving an opinion, Jimmy, in terms of like a political position that you might have for or against gay marriage, let's say. But this is specifically saying that a certain group of people are not going to be welcome in our locker room, which, again, as Pablo mentioned, happens to be in San Francisco, which obviously has one of the more well-known LGBT communities in the country.
Well, that's not his call. He wouldn't welcome him in his locker room. So what you do in this situation, since he's ignorant, is you educate him. But you don't string him up because he's not ready, because his mind can't get around
but
this idea.
I think string him up is a little strong. I understand it's a bigger speech. Anyway, Neil, go ahead.
It is a bigger speech.
I just feel like we've done a 180 in some ways from when we talked about this a few months back when some kids did a war whoop at an Elizabeth Warren rally, and we were a little less accepting of people that needed to get their mind around it, what they meant to be joking, and they were led in a certain direction. So I'm not agreeing with what he said. I actually was about to do the same fill-in-the-blank analysis that we just heard, but, you know, I do think that at some point the bullying about PC stuff just gets in the way.
Well, I think where I got to push back is
okay, Pablo, go ahead.
I mean, this is pretty clearly transparent prejudice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, this isn't, I mean, being PC is one thing, but being completely insensitive and basically, you know, denigrating somebody on the basis of identity is a pretty, as I said, a pretty low bar to have to clear in terms of avoiding that. I mean, I just feel like in sports in particular, I mean, I think all of these athletes have a responsibility given their platform. And honestly, Jimmy, in terms of the pushback, I mean, I'm not saying we should fire the guy, but I am saying that the marketplace of ideas as it is constituted at present should have vociferously rejected the attempted sale that he was trying to make.
Well, yeah, I mean, and by bullying, what do we mean? I mean, are they? Is anybody saying you can't play? Is anybody saying you're cut from the team? Is anybody saying, I mean, I don't know what.
I'm drawing comparisons to other black men in the media that have been called on the carpet for saying things that have been construed as and have been outright homophobic. You know, we call for boycotts of their music. We call for them to be fired. Call for them, you know, to, you know, and for me, what we should call for is a dialogue because they're clearly ignorant.
Sure.
Ignorant.
Well,
and,
I mean,
and we educate them. We don't want their jobs. We want them to be smarter.
But
Jimmy,
I think in this case, if it were a white player who had said those same remarks, I think that the outrage would be as unanimous as it is here. I think, again, you know, it goes into this whole narrative, you know, that we've talked about on the barbershop about whether or not a professional sports athlete who's gay might actually come out. And I think that, you know, statements like this really do show the uber macho nature that currently still exists and is pervasive in locker rooms around the country today.
I mean, I don't know how this is different from the marketplace rejecting Rush Limbaugh as a color commentator for Monday Night Football because they felt a lot of the people who listened to him felt that his comments about,
McNabb.
For example, Donovan McNabb when he was at the Eagles were racist. And they said, you know what? This is a sport with
we
a lot of African-American representation. We're not saying as a citizen you don't have a right to your comments. What we're saying is we don't want to listen to you doing color commentary on Monday Night Football.
Well, the difference, to my mind, is that Rush is employed to be in front of a mic. This gentleman was not employed to be in front of a mic. He's employed to carry a ball. What do we want from him? We want him to be Charlie Rose? What do we want from him? I mean, come on.
That would be entertaining.
Jimmy, this isn't that
That would be
hard,
entertaining.
Man.
All right, I think we got this. I understand where everybody's coming from. This is very interesting. This is very entertaining. Thank you. Very civil, too. Very civil.
You.
If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, National Review contributing writer Neil Minkoff, and sports writer Pablo Torre. Back to you, Jimmy.
All right, Michelle, thank you. Let's switch teams here. No, not like that. Ravens linebacker Ray Lewis. Ray Lewis, he may have been happy to have a spotlight on somebody else this week. You know, he's set to retire after the Super Bowl, and folks have been saying he's one of the greatest players ever, except this week the story hasn't been about his greatness. It hasn't been that positive at all. Sports Illustrated reported that he's been using an unusual banned substance. Pablo, what's that about?
He's still clutching his pearls, Pablo.
I mean, you guys are not familiar with deer antler spray?
Yeah, wait. I thought that was the active ingredient
in old
English cologne. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure
Neil used to prescribe this all the time back in the day.
I wouldn't prescribe it because it's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, well, maybe Neil can
what it is. I want to hear it.
From the sports perspective, what we've learned is that deer antler spray contains IGF-1, which is allegedly effective in some cases in healing cartilage and tendon injuries, but it's also banned by the NFL because it has performance-enhancing alleged qualities, potentially. The SI story was sort of talking about how I think the largest takeaway from this story is, number one, that maybe it's a PED-type substance that he used in trying to recover faster, but at the same time, it also is really dubious, and the guys who sold it allegedly to Ray Lewis are guys, I mean, it was a former male stripper who sells this stuff out of a van and his office is in the back of a fitness center. It's just kind of the lengths athletes go to for these sorts of cures and for any edge possible. And Ray Lewis obviously is at the center of this for a lot of reasons.
I'm dying to hear what Neil has to say about this. I know you're not practicing anymore,
but
this whole question of, you know, that some people think the whole idea that this is dangerous when you're talking about football is so ridiculous that why are we even talking about this? Football is inherently dangerous, so why are we making a big deal out of that? And what's your perspective on this?
Well, the fact is that we only know what hormones are because scientists in Europe in the 1500s responded to rooster extract. I mean, that that's how we discovered hormones. There is tremendous cross-reactivity across all types of animals. And that deer lose their antlers, they regrow them. The chemicals that regrow those antlers every year are very powerful growth factors that are incredibly similar to IGF-1, which is like insulin, or human growth hormone. And that the issue is that if they're being used now, I grant that God only knows what was really in the back of the van. But if they really are using the deer antler extract and muscles are growing, then some of the muscles that could be growing would be, the heart and the diaphragm. And if those not start to get too big to work properly, you have some real problems.
You know what? I'm so disgusted right now. I know I'm being a girl about it, but I'm so disgusted now. I don't even want to.
Really, because I'm drinking a pint of reindeer blood just to get that strength.
Rhinoceros.
I totally love the visual of like some skeevy guy selling dope out of a van. You know,
let
A-Train with this. Go ahead, man.
Well, you know, when it comes to the whole discussion about the legacy of Ray Lewis, many people are reminded about what happened 13 years ago in January of 2000 when Ray Lewis was initially charged with 2 counts of murder, but making deals with prosecutors, he later pled guilty to 1 charge, misdemeanor of obstruction of justice, in relation to the stabbing deaths of 2 people outside of an Atlanta nightclub after the 2000 Super Bowl.
Which the 2 people who were charged were acquitted.
I'm getting to that point, Michelle. Okay. So this latest deer antler, controversy, in terms of the entire narrative of Ray Lewis's legacy, is just the latest and sort of the cherry on top for many people. And, I know a lot of people who are not rooting for the Ravens because of Ray Lewis.
Yeah. I mean, whatever happened with his legal troubles, I mean, that can't be the gist of his legacy. I mean, why when you've done something and you've handled all the business behind it, why can't you just live the rest of your life? It's like, what is he, OJ?
I think that this gets at his legacy on the field.
Go ahead,
that's the problem with the deer antler stuff, is that if he was using it and if it was the real deal actual antler supplement, then it brings into question his legacy on the field. And that's where I think the real tarnish comes.
You know, Pablo, you were saying, though, that you feel that people just have a different attitude about these substances in different, like, it's really, people really care about this stuff in baseball and other sports less. Why is that?
Yeah, you brought up a great point when you talked about, I mean, these guys are already violently hurling themselves at each other as fast as possible, and they're all sort of going all out, and it's obviously a very physical gladiatorial game. And that's the difference between the NFL and MLB. I think as much as we talk about the on-field legacy of Ray Lewis, which is a very valid discussion to have because of this news, I think there's a big difference in terms of how fans and how the public reacts. With baseball, we think about hallowed records, those magical numbers for home runs and so forth. And we think of it as a game of skill. Whereas football, I think people, it's sort of an open secret at this point that the NFL is rife with performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, HGH on down, a lot of which isn't tested for and can't be tested for. And the question is, do people really care? And I feel like a lot of people do not, because it's such a physical game, and that's sort of the point.
All right. One more point is that Ray Lewis says he's never failed a drug test, and I'll just...
Neither did Lance Armstrong.
I know.
Not particularly meaningful science.
Here we go.
Here we go. All right. Before we go, guys, quit. Hands on your hearts. Let's do it.
And the home of the brave.
That was, of course, Beyonce, who's star of the halftime show. You're crying. I know you are. I know we all are. Well, Jimmy's not. But star of the halftime show, and that was she was being dissed for lip-syncing at the anthem at President Obama's inauguration, and she was saying, yes, I can sing. Thank you so much. Does that put the rest to it, Arsalan?
The only thing that could have topped it is if after singing The Home of the Brave, you hear a loud thud from her dropping the microphone and walking off the stage.
Yeah, like Eric B. and Rakim style. Yeah, she just drops the mic. I don't know why you guys won't love her when she makes herself so easy to love. I mean, just let her be great. Please.
I think they love her. I think there's a lot of love for Beyonce right here.
I have just 2 points. One, Yo-Yo Ma was fake celloing, which I think is much worse than the last inauguration. And I'm a guy. Beyonce can do whatever Beyonce wants, and I'm going to have a high level of tolerance for it.
Amen, brother.
We do not deserve Beyonce. And at that meeting, my sports media colleagues yesterday basically, verified as much. It was like they're interviewing the Queen of England. Like, nobody wanted to step on her toes. Opening with that song was maybe the most magisterial beginning to a press conference in the history of press conferences.
Okay, I think wow. that settles.
I'm not going to be the guy to defame Beyonce.
All right, that settles it. All right, Pablo Torre, senior writer for ESPN.com, with us from our NPR studios in New York. Neil Minkoff, he's a former doctor turned healthcare consultant, a contributor to the National Review, with us from Boston. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of TheMuslimGuy.com. Jimmy Israel, writer and culture critic and adjunct professor at Cuyahoga Community College. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Thank you.
Good weekend.
Yep, yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast in the iTunes store or at NPR.org. That's our program for today. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's talk more on Monday. Home of the brave.